Al-Qaeda began rebasing itself far from Afghanistan after 1989, taking advantage of the conditions in the weak and failed African states of Sudan and Somalia. Former Egyptian army officer Saif al-Adl, now Al-Qaeda's military commander, is quoted in the book Al-Zarqawi, the Second Al-Qaeda Generation, by Fuad Hussein, a Jordanian journalist. Al-Quds Al-Arabi started serializing the book in May 2005. Al-Adl outlines Al-Qaeda's shift towards Africa. After God granted the Muslim Mujahideen in Afghanistan victory against the Russians, and when disagreements began to emerge among factions of Afghan Mujahideen, many of our Arab brothers were thinking of returning to their native countries, including the Saudis, Yemenis, and Jordanians, who had no problems with the security services in their homeland. On the other hand, we, the Egyptians and our Syrian, Algerian, and Libyan brothers, had no alternative other than to stay in Afghanistan, fight on the front lines of jihad, or go to safe places where there were no powerful central governments. Therefore, we chose Sudan, Somalia, and some underprivileged African countries. Some fraternal brothers had already left to the countries that won independence from the disintegrating Soviet Union, while others spread to the four corners of the world. Jamal al-Fadl, the Sudanese citizen who became an early member of al-Qaeda and was a government witness in the 2001 trial of four men accused in al-Qaeda's bombing of two U.S. embassies in Africa in 1998. Extracts from his testimony follow and are salted through this book. In 1989, I remember in a guest house for al-Qaeda members, they started talking. In Afghanistan, we don't have too much work because the Russians, they left. And they talked about the government change in Sudan and how the Islamic National Front runs the government over there and that they are very good. And they want to make a relationship with al-Qaeda and that if we move over there, it's better because it's near the Arab world. Afghanistan is too far. Bin Laden decided to send some people to Sudan at that time to discover what was going on over there. And when they came back, I remember I was in Coast Area in Farouk camp in eastern Afghanistan. Some of the al-Qaeda members in the camp got lectured by Abu Hajar al-Iraqi. He said he went over there and met some of the Islamic National Front in Sudan, and they are very good people, and they are very happy to make this relationship with al-Qaeda. And he said, I have some books from the scholar in that group named Dr. Hassan al-Turabi. I went with some members of al-Qaeda, and we start to rent houses and farms in Khartoum. We rented houses for the single people and some houses for the people that got family. And also, we bought farms for a form of military training. The first farm I bought for $250,000. I bought in my name a salt farm in Port Sudan. It's around 1,100 kilometers from Khartoum, the capital city, for around $180,000. Jamal Ismail from Jihad Magazine. The Sudan government extended an invitation for bin Laden. They opened the borders for Arabs and Muslims to invest and to visit Sudan. And I think Sudanese, especially Dr. al-Turabi, played a very, very important role in convincing Sudanese President Omar Bashir to bring Osama, because by bringing Osama, others will come with him. Ayman al-Zawahiri and al-Jihad group. And you don't have anyone better than Osama at that time to raise funds and to help the government. Hassan al-Turabi was released from prison in Sudan in July 2005, after falling out with the regime in 1999. The de facto leader of Sudan during the 1990s, Turabi today plays down his once close relationship with bin Laden. I met bin Laden in this chair once. I never invited him for dinner here. It was only to chat, to visit for a while. And I then visited his home, but it wasn't for dinner or lunch or anything. He wasn't present in public life, not in the mosque and not in the papers. He was just investing here. His temperament is very cold and very gentle. Just very cool. We spoke a little bit about his country, about Saudi Arabia, and a little bit about investing. The people who knew him in Afghanistan came from all parts of the world to fight against the Russians. But they couldn't go back home. The war was over, and retroactively they became terrorists. They can't go to Egypt. They can't go to Saudi Arabia. They can't go to Algeria. Wissal al-Turabi, the wife of Hassan Turabi. My husband didn't bring bin Laden to the Sudan. Bin Laden thought that the Sudan was attractive to him and he could use his money for building the Sudan. He was planting, he was making chicken farms. He was building roads for the Sudanese people. You know, Muslim women don't meet Muslim men. And when they come to our houses, we don't see them. We don't converse with them. I didn't see bin Laden at all in my life, and he was not such an important figure in the Sudan. Nobody knew him because he was only planting at his farms in Damazin. He was planting sunflower to make oil, and he built the road from Khartoum to Damazin. He built the Port Sudan Airport, and he was supposed to be given money for that by the government. I met one of bin Laden's wives, Ali, mother of Ali, in her house. I didn't see her children, but she said the children were in another room trying to learn the Quran. I saw one room only. It was furnished, with European furniture, of course. She was a doctor and she was a university lecturer. She was very knowledgeable because she studied in Saudi Arabia. She used to go to Saudi Arabia and come during her holidays to stay in Khartoum. She was teaching Islam to some families in Riyadh, an upscale neighborhood in Khartoum. It was just like a friendly chat between women. I went once to hear what she was saying. She was saying things about the relation of Islam to the woman's status in the family. Ali was a university lecturer. Three of his wives are university lecturers. The first one is not. He has four wives. And he married the other three because they were spinsters. They were going to go without marrying in this world, so he married them for the word of God. In Islam, we do this. If you have a spinster, if you marry her, you will be rewarded for this in the afterworld because you will bring up your offspring as Muslims. And when they become Muslims, they will be merciful, they will be lawful, they won't drink, they won't kill, they won't commit adultery. I also met bin Laden's first wife. She lived in Riyadh in Khartoum. She was Syrian, she cared for her children, and she wasn't complaining of her husband marrying three other wives. Not like the modern trend now in the Muslim world. Now, a husband marries over his wife, she becomes very prudish and very angry, and she may even ask for a divorce. I invited her for supper here in the house. We just talked about how many children we have and about social subjects. You see, you don't speak in the Muslim world about how you met your husband. She was very pretty, tall, very tall. I didn't care for her. It was just a social occasion to invite somebody who came to your country, and we are very well known in Sudan. I had to do something to recognize her. Well, Sheikh Osama was not such an important person in the Sudan, so we had a very small dinner upstairs. Abu Jandal, bin Laden's chief bodyguard. His wife, Ali, the mother of Ali, asked Sheikh Osama for a divorce when they still lived in Sudan. She said that she could not continue to live in an austere way and in hardship. He respected her wish and divorced her in accordance with the Quranic verse, "Husband and wife should either live together equitably or separate in kindness." The other wives stayed with him, however, although they come from distinguished families and are highly educated. His wives, Hamza and Khalid, the mothers of Hamza and Khalid, both have doctoral degrees, one in Arabic language and the other in Islamic Sharia. Ibrahim Mohammed al-Sanusi was the assistant to Hassan Turabi. They were two of the most powerful people in Sudan when bin Laden was living there in the mid-90s. I have known Hassan al-Turabi since we were at secondary school together in 1954. He was very brilliant and intelligent during intermediate school and secondary school. He went to the Faculty of Law and then went to do his master's in the UK and then his PhD in Paris in constitutional law. Since then, I have had a relationship with him. I eventually became a governor of a province in Sudan. Osama bin Laden came to the Sudan offering his help making roads, and they assigned him to make a road north of Khartoum. And he began to make canals and cultivating soil and sunflower oil. It was very successful. I remembered he showed us a sunflower. It was 30 centimeters, a very big one. In this way, we knew him for the first time. He was a very decent man. He was always silent, and he was very religious and generous, and he never had the appetite for the luxurious. At that time, Dr. Turabi and Osama were friends. We used to sit together and were chatting about his agricultural schemes and how he made the roads and the kinds of stones he used. I didn't think he was the right man to speak to about politics. Osama just came to my country and helped me, and at that time I was grateful to him. At that time still we thought he was a religious man and not a politician, because sometimes we would be meeting and he never speaks to us about politics. He asked Dr. Turabi especially about his ideas about Islam, for instance, Islam and its view on mortgages. The Egyptians sent their security men to Sudan. They were able to penetrate the circle of these Islamists around Osama and the Egyptians. They recruited the son of one of them and they gave him a microphone. The security men of the Sudan knew that and arrested the boy, the 15-year-old son of Muhammad Sharaf, a jihad member living in Sudan. The father of the boy came to the security men and asked to have his son back. They gave him the son, and then the Egyptian jihad group mounted a court hearing. They tried him in their own courts and convicted him and executed him. This is the reason why the Sudanese government wanted to expel the jihad group. They said, "You are practicing the power of a state, within our state, so you have to go out. Now you are acting like a government. You make a trial and execute people without permission." Montasser al-Zayat is the Egyptian lawyer who became friendly with Ayman al-Zawahiri in the early 1980s when they were both in prison in Cairo. Zayat and Zawahiri have in recent years become vocal critics of each other. Montasser al-Zayat. Zawahiri became so cruel that he killed the son of one of his closest confidants in front of his father. When Zawahiri was living in Sudan in 1994 with Osama bin Laden, along with hundreds of Islamic Jihad members, the security committee noticed that information was being leaked to the Egyptian government. The boy was condemned by a Sharia court that Zawahiri formed. The court said that he harmed the group by spying on its activities for the Egyptian authorities. The boy, 15-year-old Mos'ab Mohammed Sharaf, was executed in front of a number of leading figures within the group in order to deter others from committing the same crime. This incident shows how the cruel life that Zawahiri has lived has affected his character. In Zawahiri's mind, Islamic Jihad has turned from being a means to an end into being an end in and of itself. Hassan Abd Rabbah al-Surehi, a Saudi who fought with bin Laden in Afghanistan. I visited him in Sudan. He owned two buildings. He used one as his residence and the second as his company headquarters. I found him with his Egyptian cronies, Abu Ubaidah and Abu Hafs, and some Sudanese who were working in his company. I invited him to return to Saudi Arabia and told him, "I advise you to return instead of staying with this bunch." We were alone in the room. He said that he owned companies that were operating in Sudan. I told him, "You can run your companies from your country." He said, "I am tired. I miss living in Medina, in Saudi Arabia. Only God knows how nostalgic I am." Jamal al-Fadl. The first company we established was Wadi al-Akik, and we established Ladin International Company. Al-Hijra Construction built roads and bridge. They built a road 83 miles between Damazin City and Kormuk City. Mohammed Zeki Majoub, who had worked for bin Laden's businesses in Sudan during the mid-1990s, submitted the following affidavit in the matter of Minister of Citizenship and Immigration and Mohammed Zeki Majoub, Federal Court of Canada, September 6, 2000. He describes what it was like to be employed by bin Laden. I am an agricultural engineer by profession. I arrived in Canada in 1995 and immediately made claim to refugee status. While working and living in Sudan, I sometime heard the name Al-Qaeda mentioned. Individuals sometime mentioned in casual conversation this name and admitted belonging to this organization. I have never been a member, associate, or supporter of the organization known as Al-Qaeda. With respect to Osama bin Laden, I wish to state the following. Prior to leaving Egypt, I had no relationship with Osama bin Laden whatsoever. From Egypt, I went to Saudi Arabia, and from there I went to Sudan. For the first 5 months in Sudan, I had no employment, and I was trying to find a job as an agricultural engineer. In Sudan, I lived in Khartoum. While looking for work in Sudan, I approached several prospective employers. However, the salaries being offered were very low. Also, as a non-Sudanese, I was expected to have a certain number of years' experience, which I did not have. Osama bin Laden owns a company in Sudan, Al-Thimar Al-Mubaraka Agricultural Company. This company is one of many branches of a larger company involved in irrigation, agriculture, commerce, roads and bridges, etc. The company employs 10,000 people approximately. In the branch that I ended up working in, there were approximately 4,000 employees and approximately 85% were Sudanese. When I was looking for work in Sudan, there was intensive media coverage of Osama bin Laden's presence in Sudan. As well, the media ran daily reports about his business activities and various business projects. One Friday, I went to the mosque for the regular Friday prayer and met an individual whom I got to know and told him that I was looking for a job as an agricultural engineer. I also told him that my academic training was in land reclamation. I later came to learn that the man I met in the mosque was an employee of one of Osama bin Laden's companies. One of Osama bin Laden's large projects in Sudan at that time involved deforestation and the making of the soil ready for the cultivation of corn, sunflowers, wheat, and some vegetables. The man whom I met in the mosque told me that he would try to speak with Osama bin Laden about getting me a job with one of his companies. The appointment was arranged for me to meet Osama bin Laden at his office in Khartoum. Osama bin Laden met me personally and told me that he had interviewed several people with my academic qualifications, but not in the same field of specialization. He further told me that he needs to assess the persons personally, and that it is not enough to assess the person's academic qualifications. My first interview with Osama bin Laden lasted 1.5 to 2 hours. He asked me many questions about my field of specialization and about my previous work experience. I was honest and told bin Laden that I had no experience, but that I would be willing to study the project and tell him if I was able to do the job or not. Bin Laden told me to take 1 week to study the project and report back about whether I could do the job. After 1 week, I met with the general manager of bin Laden's company and provided my decision to him in writing and also discussed technical aspects of the project. It was this way that I began to work as the deputy general manager of the Al-Damazin Farms project in Sudan. I had approximately 4,000 people under my supervision, the majority of whom were temporary or seasonal workers. The area of the project that I was in charge of was approximately 1 million acres. I held this position until May 1993. During this period of my employment, I met Osama bin Laden 3 additional times. I met him once in Khartoum and 2 additional times on location at the project that I was working on. The meeting in Khartoum was solely for the purpose of reporting to him about the day-to-day operations of the project. This meeting took place in his office in Khartoum and lasted approximately 1.5 to 2 hours. The 2 meetings on location at the project took place when Osama bin Laden visited the project. I made a personal decision to leave my employment with Osama bin Laden's company. While I had agreed on a salary with Osama bin Laden after I began working for his company, I learned that others working on other projects with a lower job title and level of responsibility were getting paid more money than I was. During the course of my employment, I worked a 10-hour shift, but regularly worked 8 hours of overtime as well. In the end, I decided that if bin Laden agreed to pay equity, I may stay. Otherwise, I would resign. I resigned as the answer to my request came back in the negative through the director general of the company. After I resigned, I never saw or talked with Osama bin Laden again. Later, Osama bin Laden realized that he needed me to come back offering a higher salary and benefits. However, I did not return because I had told bin Laden during our previous discussion that if I resigned, I would not come back. During the time I worked on the project in Sudan, I heard the following about Osama bin Laden's reputation from other office employees. I heard that bin Laden had been in Afghanistan and that he had a large number of employees in Afghanistan and Sudan. I heard that he was supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and that his relationship with Saudi Arabia was not good. During the approximately 1 year that I worked for his company, I never heard that he was involved in any terrorist activities. At around August 1995, the relationship between Egypt and Sudan was deteriorating, especially due to the attempted assassination of Egyptian President Mubarak in Ethiopia during the summer of 1995, an attack carried out by Egyptian militants based in Sudan. At this time, I began to look for a way to come to Canada safely. I began looking for a passport which would allow me to enter Canada without a visa. I was told that a passport from Saudi Arabia does not require a visa to Canada, and I eventually bought a Saudi Arabian passport in Sudan for $2,500. Abu Anas, bin Laden's friend in Peshawar during the mid-1980s. I met Osama twice in Sudan. I think more than 95% of his time was for business. He failed completely. He was very angry about the Sudanese. I remember when we were in his car, he told me, "I am facing problems with the Sudanese people. They told me they never imagined in their life somebody can work 8 hours. They come for work 2-3 hours and then they go." Jamal al-Fadl. We talked with bin Laden and we asked him if we have to make money because the business is very bad in Sudan. Bin Laden say our agenda is bigger than business. We're not going to make business here, but we need to help the government, and the government help our group, and this is our purpose. Wael Jalaidan had known bin Laden in Jeddah since the early 1980s and had worked with him in Pakistan during the late 1980s. He visited him in Sudan in 1993. This is the last time he spoke with bin Laden. Until 1992, there was nothing serious about al-Qaeda or a real front. It's more of an idea. One day he disappeared, just disappeared from Pakistan. That was in 92, maybe mid-92. Then later, we have heard he's in Sudan. I met Osama in 93 in Sudan because at that time there was land given to the Muslim World League, with which I am associated, to establish their own office in Khartoum. So I went there for an official visit for 3 days. I visited Osama, and I talked to him. I said, "Do you believe that your family are happy? As long as you are out of Saudi Arabia, everybody is unhappy." Most of the family members went to him in Khartoum and tried to convince him the same. "Come back." I talked to some of his family. I said, "Why is Osama not back?" They said, "We are all trying. Even we have asked our uncle, who is a very old man, Abdullah, Mohammed bin Laden's brother. He went there. We thought if the eldest of the family would go there, he would surely come back." But Osama did not pay any respect to his uncle. Really, the big question here is, what happened? Is he the same Osama? Esam al-Ridi is the Egyptian pilot who met bin Laden in Pakistan in the mid-1980s. A decade before the 9/11 attacks, while bin Laden was based in Sudan, he reached out to al-Ridi to ask him to purchase a jet in the United States, the first time that bin Laden had interested himself in American aviation. Ridi testified about that purchase in a New York terrorism trial in 2001. Excerpts of his testimony follow. In 1992, there was quite a few communications between me and Wadi el-Hajj, bin Laden's Lebanese-American personal secretary, about the interests of Osama acquiring an airplane to be used in Khartoum. The price range? Within $350,000, and a flying range of about a little bit over 2,000 miles. Once I located an airplane with that price and that range, I've called Wadi and specifically told him it's $350,000 and I'll be offered 9% from the dealer, the owner of the airplane. This is a customary commission when you buy or sell an aircraft in the U.S. This part did not really go through. They came later with a different price. They wanted something within the $250,000 or less, and my response was, you'll never get a used jet aircraft for that price that will do the range that you want. They have some goods of their own they want to ship from Peshawar to Khartoum. I'm referring to Wadi and Osama. U.S. Stinger missiles, a highly effective anti-aircraft missile. With the reduction in the price and the range, I had limited options, one of which was a military aircraft under the designation of T-389, which is the equivalent of a civilian aircraft called Sabre 40. The airplane was in storage, what we call Boneyard in Tucson, Arizona. So we pulled the aircraft out of the storage, and we had to go through certain checks mechanically to make it acceptable by the FAA. I spent about a total of $230,000. I refurbished it completely. And we took off from Dallas-Fort Worth to Khartoum. The airplane had a range of about 1,500 miles. You cannot really cross the Atlantic with that range, so we had to go up north almost to the pole and cross down to mainland. The first flight was Dallas-Fort Worth to Sault Ste. Marie at the Canadian border. From there on to a place 67 latitude north in Canada, and then to Iceland, to Rome, Cairo, Cairo-Khartoum. It should have taken 2 days at the most, but actually we had some technical problems due to the bad weather in Frobisher Bay. It was minus 65, so we lost hydraulics, and we had a crack in the window. I just parked the airplane at Khartoum Airport. It must have been the same day, at night, we were offered dinner on Bin Laden's behalf at his guest house. We had dinner and chatted. I gave the keys of the airplane to Osama bin Laden. We collectively agreed on to come to the airport the next morning to look at the airplane. I went early morning to the airplane, got it ready, cleaned it from the previous flight, and waited for Osama. Then I was told to go to the office. I had few other receipts to finish with the accountant and to meet with Osama. We were supposed to discuss an offer for me to work with him. The offer was earlier discussed over the phone with Wadi, and I said we will delay those things until I come there and see Khartoum itself. The offer was to work with him to fly that particular airplane, and to also set up an operation of crop dusting because he's into the agriculture business. Before we start discussing the offer, I had few things to discuss with Osama on a personal level relating to the days in Peshawar during the 80s and relating to my stand that led me to leave Peshawar. I told him, regardless what you think, I want you to hear it from me. I do oppose the fact that you are a rich man trying to be a military leader. At the time, I did not think that you have any military background, nor did you have any military experience. Thus, I think that what you have done to some of the guys is flat killing, not jihad. Now, perhaps after so many years, you have gained so much experience, and now it's a different situation. He said, well, thank you very much. He was very acceptable of the critiques. And later he said, this is not jihad. This is strictly business. And this is an official, certified company in Khartoum. Bin Laden offered me $1,200 a month salary. I said, this is to do what exactly of the three jobs? I mean, flying the airplane, doing the crop dusting and the cargo. $1,200. He said, that's the offer. This is the highest that I'm paying around the company for my highest officers. I said, that's fine. I have heard enough about Khartoum. There is a high inflation in the country. Schools are very expensive for expatriates. The furniture also is very expensive. It is not a healthy environment at all, so I guess it's going to cost me much more than that. So if you are paying this price for your highest officers, that does not mean that I should be paid equivalently because I do a different job. Reedy turned down the job. He would return to Sudan more than a year later for his final meeting with bin Laden. Jamal al-Fadl describes bin Laden's living situation. Bin Laden's guest house, it's in Riyadh City, Khartoum. It's a big house and three floors with a front yard and backyard. Bin Laden spent most of his time in the guest house. When we go over there, we do the prayer together, and sometime we take dinner together and we talk. Bin Laden liked to sit in the front yard and talk about jihad and about Islam and about the Al-Qaeda in general. In the second floor, he got big room. It's only for him. Sheikh Abdul Ghaffar the imam of the Khartoum mosque where bin Laden worshipped. He came here in 1991 and stayed here until 1996. He lived in this area. The weather here is very good. Also, all of the people here in the area, they are first class. This mosque is the nearest mosque to his house. He used to come to the mosque for prayers 5 times a day, and he came to the mosque always very calm. He was a very, very decent man and the very wisest man, and really a good Muslim. I asked him to address the Muslims in the mosque. He refused. He would just come to do his prayers, no more than that. Osama and his kids and one of his guards would come to the mosque for 2 or 3 minutes before prayer time. And after they did their prayers with the imam, he would leave the mosque again after 2 or 3 minutes also. He did not stay a long time. He was very simple, really very simple. He put his blankets on the floor and he always slept on the ground. I visited him once or twice when he was sick or he asked for me from the mosque. And he always had his food in one dish. Very simple types of foods. It is not often that you find it like that, a rich family as famous as his. You know that he is very rich? A good Muslim. 100%, you know?